And welcome to the latest edition of Virtually Speaking Science. I'm Alan Boyle, science editor at NBC News and your host. And we're going to be talking about the Large Hadron Collider, the International Collider of Mystery, which has been involved in one of the big discoveries of the past decade. I mean, you could argue it's one of the biggest discoveries in the past 40 years, because that's how long people have been looking for this strange thing called the Higgs boson, the last fundamental particle, the last missing piece in what's known as the Standard Model of Physics, which is one of the most successful theories in the history of science. So we have Matt Strassler, theoretical physicist, visiting professor at Harvard, to talk with us about the LHC, what it found, what it will find, and how this discovery process works anyway. So it's going to be a great hour, and we're glad you're here. First, I want to get a few shout-outs out of the way. Thanks to the Exploratorium for hosting us in their Second Life auditorium. And if you haven't tried the show in Second Life, give it a try sometime. There's a great parallel interaction that's going on, and we really do invite a lot of questions in the chat room, and we've got a great group, and we hope that someday you'll be able to join us and join the in-crowd in Second Life. You can also hear us on Blog Talk Radio, and this show is going to be archived after the live event, so if you miss any part of it, please do check back with Blog Talk Radio, and you can hear the whole thing. Thanks to our producer, Sherry Reason, for virtually speaking. And thanks also to James Emley, who performed the Cosmic Log theme you heard at the top of the show. He's the rocker scientist, and really appreciate his performance. So without further ado, let's go to the show. Welcome to Matt Strassler. Glad to have you on again. You're a veteran of Virtually Speaking Science, and so we're so glad that you're coming back.
Well, thanks very much for inviting me back.
And so let's get right into it, that we've heard a lot about the Large Hadron Collider over the past couple of years, but it's been a while since the LHC has been in operation, and maybe you could tell us what the status is for the machine.
Well, I think the excitement in the field is growing as the process of restarting the Large Hadron Collider is well underway. The machine was shut down at the end of 2012 so that it could be upgraded and some repairs could be made in order that it could be restart in 2015 with a larger energy per proton-proton collision. And with a larger collision rate, so that we could explore places that we haven't explored at all and explore some of the places in more detail that we've already investigated to some degree.
Mm-hmm. And so I talk a little bit about that in the story that's on the NBCNews.com website, that the LHC is just getting ready to make some new discoveries, and as people will remember, the Higgs boson was found. And does that mean it's mission accomplished and we just move on to the next big thing, whether that's dark matter or something else?
Well, I think it's important to understand that the discovery of the Higgs boson was the first step in the LHC's program. At the time that the LHC began, we didn't know for sure that that there would be a Higgs particle. And so it was very exciting to discover that indeed there is one, and that some of its properties are similar to what we expected. But we've only taken a very rough look at it. And so we want to take a much, much closer look. One of the reasons that the Higgs particle is so important, the main reason indeed it's so important, is not that it's critical in and of itself. Sometimes you'll hear people say that the Higgs boson is responsible for all the mass in the universe, but this is really not true at all. The Higgs particle doesn't give mass to anybody. The Higgs particle doesn't give mass to anybody. There aren't any Higgs particles in this room. There aren't any hanging around these days. We only make them with great difficulty at the Large Hadron Collider. But the Higgs field, in which the Higgs particle is just a little ripple, that's the really important thing. That is it's the Higgs field which gives mass to the electron and mass to various other elementary particles that we know about. And it is this Higgs field which is responsible for keeping us alive, because without the Higgs field doing what it does, if the Higgs field were turned off or if it didn't exist at all, the electron wouldn't have a mass. And if the electron didn't have a mass, atoms would fall apart. And that would mean no planet and no people. So we really want to understand the Higgs field. And the Higgs particle is our window into the Higgs field. So having discovered it, we now know that the Higgs field really exists. But only by studying the Higgs particle in much greater detail over the next few years will we be able to start to understand whether our understanding of the Higgs field is complete or whether we're just scratching the surface of this mysterious feature of our universe.
We're already getting questions into the chat room in Second Life. And so this crowd is really up on it. Ilse Hesse asks, the Higgs boson was similar to the one that we were looking for, but was it not exactly the one that we were looking for? Is it possible that there's more than one type of Higgs boson?
Well, all of these are great questions. These are open questions. One of the reasons we're running the accelerator over the next few years is in order to investigate the particle that we've discovered in great detail to find out, is it the simple vanilla Higgs particle which shows up in the standard model's equations, or is it something more subtle, more elaborate? Are there indeed other types of Higgs particles that we haven't discovered yet? These are open questions. There's no way to answer them until we have much more study with much more data. So at the present time, all we can say is we have a rough sense of what this particle is like, and roughly speaking, to the extent that we have a sense for it, it's consistent with the vanilla possibility, that it's the vanilla possibility being, in some sense, the simplest possible Higgs field and the simplest possible Higgs particle that you could imagine if you're a theoretical physicist. But there are many other varieties of types of Higgs particles that could be present in nature, and some of them look quite a lot like the vanilla one when you first start out. So only when we've made measurements of the Higgs particle that are sort of accurate at the 10% level, 5% level, even 1% level, will we really be confident that we're dealing with the vanilla case. And so
case,
we have a long road
to play. Is it a case that it's a difference between 124.6 and 124.7, or are there different characteristics that you're looking for? Is it just one number or more?
No. So in fact, the one thing that the standard model does not predict of the properties of the Higgs particle, which is the one thing we actually had to measure and discover, is the mass of the particle. We didn't know what the mass would be. So it was only the experiment which told us that, and still we don't understand where that number comes from. So we do want to measure the mass very precisely, but the precise number doesn't tell us very much in detail. However, what the standard model does tell us is if you know the mass from the experiments, then you also know how often it should be produced and in what ways. And you know how often it decays to this type of particle or that type of particle, and with what probabilities. So, for example, the standard model like vanilla Higgs at 125 GeV over C squared, which is the mass of the particle that we've discovered in 2012, has the property that it will decay to bottom quarks and antiquarks about two-thirds of the time, and it'll decay to two particles of light, two photons, about 1/1000th of the time, and so on. And all of those numbers are predicted with great precision in the standard model. And if any one of them is out of place, that will mean that the Higgs particle, and therefore the Higgs field, is interacting in some way with a type of particle or some sort of new force that we are currently unaware of. So we want to measure all of these different things, all the production rates for the Higgs particle, and all of the decays, all the different types of decays that it has, and measure them very precisely to see if they agree with the standard model's predictions. We're also
now, Zandria, Matt, I was going to say, yep. Zandria 21 asks, she has heard that there are apparently two energies or two bumps, perhaps, in energy levels, and was wondering if that bears on this question of what kind of critter the LHC has in its little cage.
Well, in fact, right now there's only one. I'm not sure exactly what Zandri 21 is referring to. There were various rumors which baited into the press that weren't interpreted very well by the press reports. I think perhaps back in late 2012, there was some odd situation where CMS was measuring one mass and ATLAS was measuring a different mass for the Higgs particle. But of course, that happens in any experiment, in any set of experiments, because no measurement is perfect. So it takes some time before, as you get more data and as the measurements improve their quality, before everyone agrees they're seeing exactly the same thing. At present, there's no significant discrepancies between the two experiments in terms of what they observe. There's only one particle there that we've seen so far. And so at this point, everything is consistent with just a single vanilla Higgs particle, and that's all we know at present. But, of course, the excitement is we're going to learn a lot more, because up to now, over the 2011 and 2012 period, there were about 1 million Higgs particles produced, although Higgs particles are not easy to see, so we certainly didn't observe all million of them. But over the next 5 to 10 years, the number is going to go up to 10 million, eventually 100 million, and with those sorts of numbers, we should be able to learn much, much more about this type of particle.
Is it a good thing that the Higgs particle might be a vanilla particle? Vanilla kind of implies that it's all understood.
Well, I think if you're a theoretical physicist like myself, you would be disappointed if it turns out that it's vanilla. And the reason is that the standard model is a consistent set of equations. Without the Higgs particle, it's not. So we knew there had to be something like the Higgs particle to be added. But having found the Higgs particle and a vanilla type one, the equations of the standard model form a consistent whole. There's nothing that has to be added. But the standard model has many puzzles. For example, the standard model does not explain why there is electromagnetism, a strong nuclear force, a weak nuclear force, and why they have the particular strengths that they do. It doesn't explain why we have six types of quarks. It doesn't explain why they have the particular masses that they do. It only explains how they can get mass, but it doesn't explain why the top quark is so much heavier than the up quark. And what we're hoping is that some of these puzzles about the standard model will be answered by the Large Hadron Collider and will be related to some non-vanilla-ness, let us say, some interesting flavoring of the Higgs. And this might not be the case. It might be that the secrets to these puzzles lie beyond this particular accelerator. In the end, it doesn't really matter what physicists want. What we want to do most is figure out what nature is actually doing. So we're hopeful that we will learn the answers to some of the questions that we have. But in any case, our job right now is to figure out what is nature actually doing. Do we actually have a vanilla Higgs, or do we have something more subtle and elaborate?
And there's a buzzword called naturalness to these sorts of theories. Could you explain what's going on with the quest for naturalness?
Well, naturalness is a very rich and interesting subject, and it's in many ways the most important question which is driving the searches at the Large Hadron Collider in the current, will be driving things in the next few years. It has already been very important in the last few years, but it is a problem which is subtle enough that it really hasn't been explained widely to the public. And there was good reason in some sense for this, that until we actually found a vanilla-like Higgs, the problem really wasn't sharp enough and crisp enough to emphasize its importance. But it's really important and it's subtle. So let me take a minute to tell you a little about it. The weird thing about the Higgs field and the Higgs particle in the standard model, is that on the one hand, it's a vanilla Higgs. It's the simplest possible thing you can write down. But on the other hand, it's doing something very non-vanilla. If you were to take a theory that was like the standard model, had maybe all the same types of particles, but has slightly different masses for those particles, has slightly different strengths for the forces, and you asked, what would the Higgs field in that theory, in that universe described by those equations, be doing? The answer is there are two very natural things that you would expect to find. You would either expect to find that the Higgs field is just turned off, mm-hmm. which would mean no mass for the electron, or it's turned on, but it's turned on a huge amount, which would mean the electron would be so heavy it would almost be a black hole in and of itself. The weird thing about our universe is that our Higgs field is turned on, but just a little bit. And this mm-hmm. is not generic. This is non-generic, or one might say unnatural. It's strange. It's weird that we live in a universe that has a vanilla Higgs doing this very non-vanilla thing. So this is known as the naturalness puzzle, and people have known about it since the 1970s, and now that we actually see that there is a standard model-like, vanilla-like Higgs in the data, now we really have to deal with this problem. So there are two very different types of solutions that you can imagine to this puzzle. One possibility is that there's some principles of nature that we don't currently know, something about the laws of nature that has to be added to our understanding.
That sounds tasty.
Would mean, yes, it would certainly be interesting, and it would flavor the Higgs particle.
Mm-hmm.
It would mean that the Higgs field and the Higgs particle are somehow interacting with some other particles and fields that we don't currently know about. And these have the property that they make this fact about the Higgs field, that it's on but just a little bit, generic again. It's as though by making the Higgs field a little non-vanilla, we can make its behavior more vanilla, much more vanilla. And so when you hear buzzwords like supersymmetry or extra dimensions or little Higgs or twin Higgs and on and on and on, there are lots of different ideas that people have. These are all ideas of changing the laws of nature by adding some new particles to the world such that this apparently very non-generic behavior actually is generic when you incorporate these additional ideas. And I could say more mm-hmm. about that if you like. But let me first say the other type of solution, the other class of solution to the naturalness puzzle, is that it's not a property of the particles or of the forces or of intrinsic to nature itself. It's a property of the history of the universe, or at least our part of the universe, that assured that even though the generic situation is for the Higgs field to be on and hugely on, because of the way the universe evolved, it ended up in a situation where the Higgs field is Higgs field is on, but just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And that would potentially have a very different consequence in terms of what we would see in the data. And in fact, we're still exploring all the possibilities. And so I would say that this class of solutions is less well understood. And it's not obvious that any sign of this would show up at the Large Hadron Collider. It might have to show up in other types of experiments. But people are still thinking about this. So when you hear about the buzzword,
that latter class of scenarios sounds a lot like what people have talked about with other big cosmic questions about why the universe is the way that it is. And sometimes the explanation is put forward that we just, you know, it's just a nice way for the universe to turn out, that if it were any different, there might not be humans around to speculate on what the nature of the universe could or couldn't be. So they call it the landscape question.
Right. And so one of the possible historical explanations is that the universe is huge beyond anyone's imagination, that it has different patches with very different laws of particle physics. And in most of those parts of the universe, the details of that world are unsuitable for any sort of life to ever have evolved. And in that case, we happen to live in a patch with these strange properties, because those properties are ones on which the existence of chemistry and rocks and things out of which you could make people are dependent. Now, there is some interesting, you know, one should take such an argument seriously, but there's also been detailed counter-arguments to this, where people have pointed out that you could actually have a world in which the Higgs field was turned on full, but you mm-hmm. change other aspects of the world in such a way that they sort of balance out, and you end up with things that you end up with electrons that are very light and protons that are very light. You can make atoms, after all. So this suggestion that somehow the properties of our world are fundamentally dependent on the Higgs field being on but just a little bit doesn't really seem to hold water. So, but it could still be correct. It's just that it can only be correct if there are some additional features of the world which we also don't know about. So let's say in that case it would sort of be a combination of a historical feature of the world combined with some property of the world which we don't currently know, some intrinsic property we don't currently know.
This meshes with Randolph Azaroff's question, who says, suppose the standard model is correct, and I think that means suppose we don't really find anything that you can grab onto to open the door to a new physical theory. Where does research go from there? If things work out the way, just in that plain vanilla fashion, is that basically the end of the story?
Well, that's a great question, and it's important to emphasize from the at the very start that we know that the standard model is not correct. That is to say, we don't know. One has to separate two things.
Mm-hmm.
The standard model does not include dark matter. It does not include dark energy, and it is a very naive view of gravity. So we know it's not a complete theory. However, it's not a complete theory of the world that we know. It's a consistent set of equations, but it doesn't describe everything that we know about. And it has all these open questions. But it's possible that it describes everything that the LHC can actually measure. So as far as the LHC is concerned, it could be the whole story. So then if we ask that question, well, supposing that we work with the Large Hadron Collider and we find nothing amiss, well, there are several research directions that will continue. First of all, people are looking for dark matter, and they're going to keep looking for dark matter. And they know that something is strange in the universe, and if dark matter really exists, then we need to understand it. And if for some reason dark matter is the wrong idea and it's some strange effect of gravity, well, we have to figure that out too. So there's a lot of research to do to make sure we understand dark matter, or at least the effects that we attribute to dark matter. And dark energy is a gravitational effect that we also, the fact that the universe is not only expanding, but actually expanding faster and faster in the recent cosmic epoch. This is something we don't understand. And clearly that research into what dark energy might be is at its infancy, and we will be continuing to study that. We also know far too little about neutrinos. We learned only in the last decade or so that neutrinos definitely have masses, that they change from one type to another as they traverse the universe or as they traverse ordinary matter. And we don't know much about their history or their role. So there's a lot to do with that type of research as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole new area which is going to be opening up. That's another very exciting thing. I hope you, if you haven't already, you should definitely have an evening interview about this subject, which is that the era of studying the universe using gravitational waves, the waves in space and time that are produced by that are predicted in Einstein's theory, is going to also start in 2015. Not only the Large Hadron Collider, but also the advanced version of the LIGO Observatory is going to get going. And they're a little bit behind schedule, but not too seriously. And it will take them a little while to get up to full speed. Full speed is sort of the wrong term, up to full capacity. It's just a giant experiment which sits there and waits for it to be jiggled a tiny bit as a space-time wave goes by. There's a very good reason to expect that the advanced LIGO, if it works as it is supposed to, is powerful enough and sensitive enough that it will discover some of the very strange, powerful astronomical events that can occur, such as the mergers of two black holes, that must occur when galaxies merge together. And they will start seeing signs of this within the next 3 to 5 years. So that's another area which will open up, where we will begin to explore aspects of the universe that we currently can't investigate at all, and there could certainly be surprises. So I think, you know, one should understand that the Large Hadron Collider, of course, is just one direction in which those of us who, I'm not sure what name to put on us, but those of us who want to understand the laws of nature at the most elementary and fundamental level will be pursuing.
That's a great tip on LIGO too. I'm actually speaking to you from in the Seattle area, and LIGO has two detectors, one which is in Washington State, a few hours away from here, and the other in Louisiana, but that's going to be a fascinating experiment. I think I was hoping that LIGO would produce detection even before this time, but I guess it is going to take an advanced system, just as the LHC was able to take studies in directions beyond what the Tevatron was able to do, that each generation produces more data on these cosmic mysteries.
Well, one of the interesting analogies is that the LHC was a sort of no-lose machine in the sense that we knew that if our understanding of the Standard Model was correct, there was no way that a Standard Model like Higgs boson could escape detection at the Large Hadron Collider. It could have been that the Higgs boson was very non-vanilla, and then it could have taken a long time to find it, but at least we would have known for sure that the Standard Model was not correct. There's a certain sense in which advanced LIGO, as opposed to its previous less powerful incarnations, is almost a no-lose machine, because we know that galaxies collide. We can observe that. We don't actually observe the collisions. You know, they take too long for us to see them happening, but we can see, basically, galaxies in the process of colliding. And we know that every galaxy at its center, or at least most of them, probably all of them, have black holes at their center, just as the Milky Way appears to. Mm-hmm. And so when two galaxies collide, their black holes will eventually merge at the center. And we can calculate in Einstein's gravity what sort of gravitational waves are produced. And we expect that advanced LIGO is now the machine that should be powerful enough to observe this. And we will be very surprised, and it will already be a great, in some sense, shock and be a source of excitement if they don't see this. So advanced LIGO is perhaps like is with respect to gravitational waves, perhaps the way the LHC was with respect to the Higgs. And just as advanced LIGO might discover things that are beyond that, that no one is expecting, or that maybe some people are expecting but are certainly would-be surprises, the LHC now in its next run is starting to explore territory where all sorts of surprises could occur.
And maybe it's a good time to talk about some of those potential surprises. I think you've made clear that it's not mission accomplished for the Higgs boson, that there is much still to be learned about that piece of the puzzle. But there are some other puzzle pieces that the researchers at the LHC are hoping to grab as well. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Well, there's a very wide variety. In some sense, we could talk about quite a few of them over the remaining period. Let me just pick a couple of them. So, one of the most important aspects of the way physicists think about the naturalness problem, if the solution to the naturalness problem is in that first class, where there has to be something added to the Standard Model in order to make the behavior of the Higgs field more vanilla at the cost of making the Higgs field itself less vanilla. Well, we know that one of the puzzles is that the top quark, which is the heaviest known particle so far, it appears to get all or most of its mass from the Higgs field, just the way one would expect in the Standard Model. And because of that, it in turn has an effect on the Higgs field, such that it's trying to push the Higgs field on. It's trying to push it more on. In fact, if the top quark were left to itself, it would push the Higgs field on about as far as it could go. And now, somehow, for some reason, it doesn't do that. And the other particles in the Standard Model, some of them are trying to turn it off, some of them are trying to push the Higgs field on, but the effects don't really cancel. So one possibility, one of the most likely possibilities that people propose, is that there's some kind of particle that's similar to the top quark, but different in some detail, such that it has the tendency to try to turn the Higgs field off. So the top quark's trying to turn the Higgs field on more and more, and there's some other particle, let's call it a top partner, which is trying to turn the Higgs field off. And the way nature is arranged is that these two effects from the top quark and its partner essentially cancel. So So,
and is that where supersymmetry comes in? Would that be a
supersymmetry is one example. Supersymmetry is one of the classic examples where, in addition to a top quark, there is a particle called a top squark. Actually, there's two of them. And the top squarks pull one way, and the top squark pushes the other way as far as the Higgs field is concerned. So now, for this cancellation to work, where the top quarks effect get canceled by top squarks, it has to be that the top squarks can't be too heavy compared to the top quark.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're light enough, the LHC is probably already producing them, and the problem is just to find evidence that it's producing them. So already there have been many searches of different types looking for top squarks. The problem is that even though we know something about how top squarks are made, there are many different ways that they could decay. And what we would actually observe in the detectors of the ATLAS and CMS detectors, which are the ones that actually do the measurements at the LHC's collisions, what
mm-hmm.
we would see in those detectors depends on how the top squarks decay. So we know the top squarks are a good idea, but we have to look for them in many different ways because we're not sure how they decay. So in supersymmetry, there are these top squarks. We have to look for them. In certain types of extra dimension models, or in little Higgs, which probably most people haven't heard of, there are top partners which look more like top quarks. They're called top primes. They're like top quarks, but heavier. They don't get all their mass from the Higgs field. They get some of it from the Higgs field. And they also would cancel off the effect of the top quark on the Higgs. They would pull where the top quark is pushing. And in that case, we should be looking for them. But again, there's a number of different ways those types of particles could decay, so we need many different strategies. And people have been looking, and they will be continuing to look over the next few years. And then there's a couple of really diabolical examples where there's top partners which have the property that they don't interact with any of the standard model forces. So they're really hard to make. There's an idea called the twin Higgs, which was invented in 2005 by a few friends of mine, Chaco,
uh-huh.
Harnick, and Goh. And they pointed out that you could have particles that were kind of like top primes, but they don't carry strong nuclear forces or weak nuclear forces or electromagnetism. So they're really hard to make, and yet they could be responsible for this cancellation. So then the question is, how would you find them? And the answer is you would find them indirectly by noticing 5 to 10% effects on the Higgs, some non-vanilla features of the Higgs, but only at the 5 to 10% level. So that's a reason why we have to make measurements of the Higgs in very great detail, because the only way you can find top partners of this type at the LHC is to see these indirect effects that they would be having.
I think my mind was blown back when you were talking about the top primes, but it sounds as if there are as many possibilities as there are theorists. For example, Widget Whiteberry was asking, are we going to have to change the laws of nature or our understanding of our laws, of the laws of nature in order to accommodate what the LHC might or might not find?
Well, you know, we don't have any way other than experiment to find out whether what's coming is a small modification to what we know or a radical one. Certainly the physicists in the 1860s and 70s, as they were learning about electromagnetism, had no idea that what was coming in 30 or 40 years was special relativity and quantum mechanics. They didn't see that coming. And they just were doing physics like we're doing now, and they were expecting to, you know, learn some nice things about nature they didn't know, and they were expecting to, you know, continue to make progress, but they didn't see the revolution. And our situation is much the same. There's no way to see a revolution if it's coming. We just have to do our best and make sure we're doing getting every bit of information from the data that we can and interpreting as best we can. It is
mm-hmm.
possible that if the Higgs really is as vanilla as it is in the standard model, and our notion of naturalness somehow, the naturalness puzzle somehow is not resolved in an obvious way, it could be that the solution to the naturalness puzzle is something as radical as relativity or quantum mechanics, something that involves a deep change in the laws of nature. But we won't know that until we've studied the LHC data and other experiments in much more detail and found places where there are puzzles that we can really put our finger on. It was certainly crucial for Einstein and Planck and other people that they had experimental data that they could not explain. And right now we have some data that we can't explain. We can't explain dark matter. We can't explain dark energy. We can't explain some features of neutrinos. We can't explain the masses, the specific patterns of the masses of the particles. We do have quite a few discrepancies or puzzles. The problem is no one has as yet been able to see how those puzzles somehow fit together and how some sort of change in the laws of nature might explain a whole bunch of them at once. But maybe some young Einstein will come along in the next 10 or 20 years, or maybe a group of smart people will gradually make progress, and it'll turn out that we do need changes in the laws of nature in some significant fashion. No way to know. You can't predict the twists and turns of science.
So we could go a couple of different ways here. One is it struck me that it may be that the sort of theory that people come up with is analogous to what Einstein did with Newtonian theory, is that for a lot of things, Newtonian theory about gravitation works just fine, but then you have to invoke Einsteinian theory to take in some of the corners where Newton may not be as close to the mark as you want. And
right.
Is that similar to what we might find here, that the standard model works fine for standard things, but for non-standard things you have to go to the Strassler effect or whatever?
Well, sure, absolutely. I mean, the standard model, just like Newtonian physics, the standard model will always be something which we teach to our students. It is a remarkable set of equations in terms of the huge variety of phenomena in particle physics and beyond that it explains and predicts beautifully. We have hundreds of measurements at the LHC and thousands at previous experiments, and the standard model is dead on in so many ways, sometimes very complicated experiments, sometimes very subtle experiments where extreme precision is obtained by the experiments and tested in and compared with the standard model prediction, which is also very precise, and they work beautifully. So just like Newtonian physics will always be useful, the standard model works so well that it will always be a part of our toolbox. But presumably, because we know there are things that aren't included in it, it will be extended just as Newtonian physics was extended. And we don't know if it's going to be extended in a simple way or in a dramatic one, whether the concepts will really change or whether we'll just add a few more particles, keeping most of the concepts the same.
Mm-hmm.
The standard model is definitely one of those theories that's going to be around several hundred years from now. I'm sure of it.
So the questions are piling up. CC Carolina asks about physicists versus mathematicians, string theorists. How do they get along at CERN? How many mathematicians are working at CERN? And since physicists have certain roadblocks in that they can't really do experiments with black holes, do mathematicians have an advantage? And then CC asks, is there any work in the pipeline regarding black holes, perhaps talking about these microscopic black holes that we hear about every so often?
This is such a rich set of questions. Let me think about how to approach it, because many of the questions are really they're touching on really interesting issues, but in some sense they're not quite the right questions, because the way the field is structured is somewhat different, I think, from what the questioner imagines. So first of all, there are mathematicians who really work on pure math. There are mathematical physicists who are kind of interested in understanding how to solve the types of equations that come up in physics. There are physicists who have to do a lot of math. String theorists would be among them. But they're really interested in the physics questions. Then there are physicists who do some math and are more closely connected with the experiments. There are physicists like me who are in that category. I do some string theory when it's convenient, and so I do some sort of more mathematical things sometimes, but I'm also closely working with experimenters. And then there are some physicists who spend most of their time doing calculations which are relevant for ongoing experiments. And there's this great diversity of different types of people. So when one asks how many mathematicians work at CERN, well, I think most of the people who work at CERN would consider themselves physicists, but some of the physicists would consider those physicists mathematicians. So, you know, it's all a question of how do you view yourself and how do you view what people are actually trying to do. As far as black holes, this is a really interesting question because, of course, some issues involving black holes are astronomical questions that you can investigate with telescopes. I mean, there are going to be questions about how there are already many questions about how black holes work, which we can actually study by looking at how they bend light, by looking at how gas falls into black holes and how those black holes generate jets of particles that come out the north and south poles of these things. So there's many questions of black holes which are accessible to actual observation. Now, there are other questions about black holes which are very subtle, in particular the Hawking-type questions. The fact that black holes, if you leave them alone and don't keep feeding them, will eventually evaporate. Now, that question, unfortunately, with all the black holes that we can observe out in the universe, even if they were left alone, and none of them is alone, they're all inside of galaxies where there's plenty of gas to feed them, a black hole of the mass of, let's say, a typical supernova star that can actually collapse into a black hole, even if you let it evaporate, its lifetime would be so much longer than the age of the universe that you'd never even see it peep. So to study how black holes evaporate and some of the deep puzzles about how quantum mechanics and gravity get along in the context of evaporating black holes, this has to be done by physicists using a combination of mathematics and physical reasoning. It's actually very hard for a mathematician to address a problem like this because you have to know so much physics even to set the problem up. So it's possible that mathematicians will provide some of the mathematical ingredients for solving these puzzles, but the puzzles will most likely be solved just as general relativity was figured out partly by mathematician Hilbert, but in the end, really by physicist Einstein. You have to put the physics together with the math in the right ways to really make sure you're asking the right questions and using physical intuition to guess the answer. So I think in the end, the problems of black holes are likely to be solved by physicists. They may involve mathematics that doesn't exist yet, but they are likely to also involve deep physical insights, which we also currently lack.
Well, I can see that we're going to have far more questions than we can wedge answers into, but I'm going to keep pressing on here. Ilse Hesse asks, a friend of mine tells me that we will never travel faster than light. Finding things like the Higgs, teasing out the characteristics of gravity, are these small steps toward possibly breaking the light barrier?
Well, it's dangerous, of course, for a scientist to say never.
Arthur C. Clarke said, whenever someone says something is impossible, that person is almost always proved wrong.
Well, the problem is the almost always, right? I mean, there are things that are, you know, that really appear to be impossible in our world, and presumably some of them actually are. It's hard to guess which ones, but the thing about not being able to travel faster than light, and I leave aside the possibility that there are wormholes which allow you to take a shortcut, but even there you're not actually traveling faster than light, you're just finding a way to get from A to B through a shortcut. To actually travel faster than light seems to be in contradiction with the very geometry of how the universe is put together. In some sense, it's a property of the geometry of the universe that it's impossible for anything to travel faster than light. This is certainly true in Einstein's theory, and there are experimental consequences for things traveling faster than the speed of light, which are potentially observable. So let me give an example. You know that if you make something travel faster than the speed of sound, like a supersonic rocket or a meteor, you get a sonic boom. And so what's a sonic boom? It's a shock wave which sends a very powerful blast of sound outwards. And if you make something travel faster than the speed of light, you expect it to slow down because it will also emit a boom, which is sort of a, let's call it a photonic boom. It's a boom made of light in a similar sort of way. And in fact, we do observe these things because in material, light travels slower than it does in empty space. So in water, light travels somewhat slower than it does in empty space. You can shoot a particle, such as an electron, into a vat of water. If you shoot it fast enough, it will be traveling close to the speed of light in empty space, but it will be traveling faster than light travels inside the water. And when that happens, this electron will emit light. And we observe these things. These are called this is called Cherenkov light. And we actually use this in particle detectors. This is one of the ways of detecting particles, because if you have a fast particle moving through water, it'll emit this type of light. Now, on the other hand, if it were possible for particles to travel faster than light in empty space, you would expect them to emit light and lose energy in certain types of ways. And in fact, one of the ways that people were so sure that the experiment called OPERA, which you may recall, claimed for a short period of time
that faster-than-light neutrinos.
They might have seen neutrinos that travel faster than the speed of light. You know the joke about that came out about that. It was that the neutrinos were being fired from Geneva, Switzerland, into a laboratory in a mountain in Italy. And the joke was that, well, of course, in Switzerland, the neutrinos travel faster than the speed of light. But once they cross the Italian border, well, you know, all bets are off. So... But indeed, if neutrinos were able to travel faster than the speed of light, because neutrinos and electrons are related to each other, that would suggest a similar effect with electrons, and there would be certain effects that you would expect to observe that are not observed. And so this was an argument due to Andy Cohen and Sheldon Glashow that suggested that really there were some serious problems with this idea that neutrinos could go faster than light. And in general... for particles out of which we're made, and therefore by extension for us, to travel faster than light seems to be in contradiction not only with theory but with what we know from data. Impossible? Mm-hmm. Probably. Should we keep an open mind? Of course, but I wouldn't spend too much time expecting it. Probably should look for more plausible and also very interesting things about the universe, which could very well be out there.
Now, we've mentioned dark matter several times in the course of the conversation, but what is it that the LHC could do when it comes to solving that dark matter question, the question that focuses on the fact that there appears to be gravitational effects that are caused by some sort of mass that we don't see? And could it be that those dark matter particles are produced at the LHC, or is it more complex than that? I have a feeling it's more complex.
Well, everything in this business is more complex than it looks at first glance. It's why there's so many of us working in this subject, because there's so much to do. One should start. Let's go one step at a time. First of all, one should ask, you know, does dark matter really exist? What we see is we see effects which we attribute to dark matter. And I think 25 years ago, back when I was a student, you could really argue that maybe there isn't dark matter, and it's just something about gravity that we don't understand. Maybe all these weird effects are because we don't understand gravity.
Some people
still say
that.
Well, I think it's fair
to
say,
yeah.
And some people still say that, and that's fine. I mean, people should all, you know, an open mind should be kept until we're certain. But I think it's also true that it's much harder to make that argument now, because over the past 25 years, we've seen more and more effects that are consistent with there being some kind of substance out there that's made from objects that don't shine, that do gravitate the way matter that we're used to gravitates, but cannot be made from the type of matter that we are made from or that other particles that we know about are made from. So there must be some new thing out there that is matter and gravitates and is responsible for forming the big structures in the universe around the galaxies that the galaxies themselves eventually form around and within. So dark matter probably exists. Now, is it particles? Well, there's a debate about that. It doesn't need to be particles. One possibility is it's actually some sort of small type of black hole that was produced in the early universe. Maybe there are, in the very early universe, somehow, via some mechanism which nobody knows, there are large numbers of relatively small black holes which get formed, and they're just strewn around the universe, and they will gravitate, and they won't shine, and they'll behave very much like... they'll behave like dark matter, and so are we sure that dark matter isn't just these types of black holes? Well, there's been various attempts in recent years to rule out this possibility. In fact, one of my colleagues here at Harvard, Avi Loeb, was involved in a paper where he claimed that by studying properties of neutron stars, you could rule out this possibility completely. But his argument's been criticized, and so the debate is still open, I think. I'm not expert enough to judge the debate, but certainly the question is open. So, you know, maybe dark matter is still black holes, or maybe it's some other kind of lump made from some type of objects that we are, again, unfamiliar with.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just sort of particles such as the sort that are made at the LHC, you know, in basically extremely tiny objects. But it is possible that dark matter is just huge numbers of very tiny particles that are flying around the universe. We already know of course, particles of light are flying around the universe. The cosmic microwave background is made of photons that are flying everywhere, but that's not suitable for dark matter. There are neutrinos flying everywhere around the universe, but those are not suitable, at least the ones we know about are not suitable for dark matter. But there could be particles that are a little heavier and have the property that they don't shine very easily, so we don't observe them directly. But we observe the gravitational effect. And now you can ask, okay, if dark matter is made from particles, could they be made of particles that the LHC could detect? And again, the answer is maybe. We know of certain types of particles, such as axions, or a type of neutrino-like object called a sterile neutrino, which is it's not really a neutrino, but it's some sort of particle that, like a neutrino, is hard to observe, but it's even harder to observe than standard neutrino. These types of particles might be impossible for the LHC to produce and discover. So you would need to discover them some other way. And indeed, there are searches for these types of particles using experiments on the ground or measurements in the sky. But it's possible that dark matter is of a sort that it can be produced at the Large Hadron Collider. And if we're lucky enough that that's the case, then you can ask yourself a question. How do you discover something that is so hard to observe? Right? I mean, this thing doesn't shine, it doesn't emit light, it doesn't interact strongly with ordinary matter. So if you produce a dark matter particle, it will just sail right through the Large Hadron Collider's detectors without being observed. So how do you find it?
Well, and I know on your blog of particular significance, you spend a lot of time kind of delving into that question. It sounds as if you're really looking for something that's invisible. It's like the dog that doesn't bark in the Sherlock Holmes story.
Right. Right. I mean, now, we already have particles like this in the Standard Model. Neutrinos are just like this. Neutrinos are particles that, when they're produced at the Large Hadron Collider, we don't observe them directly. They don't hit anything on the way out. They just are produced, and they just sail right out of the detector. So how do you know that you've made one? Well, if you make something unseen, it has to recoil against something else. This is Newton's third law. Every action has a reaction, or it's known as the conservation of momentum. Or it's the fact that if a bomb explodes, some parts of it go to the left and some parts of it go to the right.
Mm-hmm.
So if you see something go to the left and you don't see anything going to the right, you can conclude that there was something there, you just didn't observe it.
Mm-hmm.
So we already
Wow.
detect neutrinos in this indirect way. So you can imagine detecting dark matter the same way. You produce it, it recoils against dark matter particles are produced, they recoil against something that you can see, and you can conclude, oh, we made something invisible, but then how do you figure out what it was? For example, how do you know that you made dark matter particles and not neutrinos? We already make neutrinos. And even if you figure out that you've made something new, how do you figure out that's dark matter and not some other new thing? That has nothing to do with the stuff that's actually out there in the universe. And both of those questions are interesting, and the answers are long. The short one is we figure out that we've made at least something new that isn't neutrinos, or at least we're making neutrinos in a new way, because in the Standard Model we can make detailed predictions of how often we make neutrinos and in what patterns. And so if we see we're making something that's invisible, but it doesn't follow those patterns, we know it's something new.
Uh-huh. And that's one of the reasons why so much of the work at the LHC is statistical. And you need the more samples, the more examples you have of a particular phenomenon, the more you can figure out what the characteristics are. Because in the end, a lot of it depends on how often something is produced rather than actually seeing a blip on a radar screen.
Exactly. So this is certainly true of most of the properties of the Higgs particle. It's true for many of the searches we do for new particles, where what we're looking for is maybe we're looking for something strange. Let's imagine, for example, that it's something strange that happens, only a tenth as often as a similar thing happens in the Standard Model. Well, So the statistics is simple. If there's something that happens 100 times, then on average it'll happen 100 times. But sometimes if you're just, you know, in any given experiment, maybe it'll happen 90 times, maybe it'll happen 110 times, just by chance.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're looking for something that happens 10 times for every, something new that happens 10 times for every 100 times the old thing happens, you're going to need to make 10,000 or 5,000 of the old thing before you'll have enough of the new thing that you'll be confident that you're not just seeing a statistical fluke in your measurement of the old thing.
It's like
so the more data
how many
you have,
pennies you flip. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's very much that. That's right. The only way to tell that the dice that you're tossing are not standard dice is to flip them many times. That's the only way you can figure it out. It's a statistical argument. And the crucial thing is that the Standard Model is such a great theory, it makes such good predictions, and these detectors are so good, they make such great measurements, that they can really benefit from these high statistical samples. If you get enough data, the measurements are so good that you can really tell the difference between a statistical fluke and something that might be really new, as opposed to being just sort of confused because your measurement's not that good and you can't really tell what you've got, which is certainly a problem if your measurement quality is not good enough.
Okay, I have a couple of quick questions to wedge in here. One is that a listener says that you mentioned in an article a term called dark mass. And how is that different from dark matter? Does that go to the question that you were addressing just a little while ago about how dark matter might not be what we think it is?
I don't think I've mentioned dark mass in any of my articles. It's certainly not a term that we use in physics. So all I can say is maybe I mentioned it in some aside as either a joke or a way of a turn of phrase. I'd suggest that the listener send me an email. Maybe I can answer the question. But no, dark mass is not a term we use. Probably the only thing I can think of is that we know there's something out there that has mass and that it's dark. But the subtlety is maybe in the term, what the term matter actually means. But I'm afraid I don't really understand the question, so I can't answer it.
And another question is it possible that we can use some of the principles discovered at the LHC to manipulate gravity?
It seems unlikely. Gravity is an amazingly weak force. And just to give you a sense for that, I mean, it's the classic point, is that it's so weak compared to electromagnetism that you have no problem lifting your arm using electric forces against the gravitational pull of the entire planet. So it's very difficult to do experiments that make gravity do anything other than what it normally does. We just don't have any simple ways of manipulating it. It would take enormous energies far beyond what we have at the Large Hadron Collider, and maybe someday in the great distant future we'll have technology which will allow us to do interesting things with gravity. But right now, with gravity, we're mostly just forced to take what nature gives us. So we're looking for gravitational waves from black holes, and that's kind of all we can get. We don't know how to do any quantum mechanics with gravity. We don't have any hope of making space-time foam or any of these other weird quantum things that
might be
properties of the theory
of
relativity.
The things you see in the movies,
We don't have any ways technically to do this, and we're not just far off. We're far, 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 far off. And just how far is really kind of captured in how easy it is for you to raise your arm against the force of the whole planet.
Another thing I wanted to touch on is something that we've discussed earlier today is the role of a theorist such as yourself with the LHC, that you don't go to work at the LHC, you're kind of a little bit on the outside. And so how does that relationship work?
Well, it's worth mentioning that even the experimentalists don't, many of the experimental, more senior experimentalists, they work from their universities or from their laboratories in other parts of the world. One does not actually need everyone to be on station. All that's needed is for for there to be a certain number of people on station. Many of them would be students and postdocs and technicians. And for there to be ways to ship the data all around the world. Of course, a lot of stuff that has to be done at the Large Hadron Collider detectors is software or data analysis, and that can be done anywhere. So even the experimentalists aren't necessarily to be found at CERN. Now, they will have meetings. Of course, the meetings also are done using virtual, they're done using video. So, but that said, every now and then it's important for people to be in the same room and to be hanging out at the cafeteria just so they can make sure they're really understanding each other and exchanging information. So there are times where there are conferences or workshops that happen at CERN, or there are times where I know that there are going to be people at CERN I'd like to talk to, and I would actually go there directly. But many times I just go to another university where one of my colleagues who's working as an experimentalist at CERN is actually doing the work. I'll be going to the University of California, Santa Barbara in a few days, and I expect there'll be experimentalists there who I want to talk to. Then I'll be going to the University of California, Davis, and there'll be experimentalists there I want to talk to. And I'll go to Fermilab, our big laboratory out in the U.S.'s big laboratory out in not too far from Chicago. And again, there'll be plenty of people to talk to. Partly there's people who are working there. There'll be a little workshop there. There'll be some people who will come to that workshop from other places. So there are many, many ways to maintain good social and scientific connections with other people which don't involve actually going to CERN. Now, then there's the other question of, you know, how does a theorist actually interact with experimentalists?
Right, that's what I was trying to get at. Theorists versus experimentalists. How do you get along?
Well, sometimes it is versus. it's a complicated relationship, and also again, there are many different types of theorists and many different types of experimentalists. So one has to keep in mind that there are a couple of thousand people on ATLAS, a couple of thousand people on CMS who are active and involved, and they're in different parts of the world. And then among theorists, there are the people who are really doing the detailed standard model calculations, so they can make very detailed predictions, which the experimentalists can compare with data. And they would work. They often don't work with the experimenters very closely. They just provide the calculation results. Others of them, however, are working very closely and making sure that the computer programs which are needed to compare the results with the very complicated environment of the LHC are implemented in a way that's consistent with how the experiments actually work. Now, somebody like me, who has a broader research program, again, as I mentioned, I've done everything from string theory to working in great detail with experimenters. What I tend to be doing is looking at the questions, such as the naturalness question or the dark matter question, and thinking about what might the universe throw at us? What might there be in nature that we're not thinking about? And then asking the question, well, what sorts of experiments, what sort of measurements do we need to be doing at the Large Hadron Collider? And if it's a type of measurement that the experimenters are already doing, fine, I don't need to tell them anything new. But sometimes I find a phenomenon in nature and no one is looking for it. I find a phenomenon that might be present in nature and no one is looking for it. And so then I have to ask myself, well, what advice should I be giving the experimenters? Can I point out a strategy that they could use to find this phenomenon if it's there? Is there perhaps even a problem where the very way they take the data, which involves what's known as a trigger where they have to actually throw away most of the data they collect as they collect it because there's just not room to store it all. Is there perhaps in that process of throwing away some of the data a risk that they're throwing away this new phenomenon and thereby throwing out the baby with the bathwater? Well, so that's something that I and they worry about a lot. And so In those circumstances where I have a suggestion about how they should collect the data or how they should use the data, how they should measure things, or implications of measurements that they've made that they may not have recognized yet. For example, they may have made a whole bunch of measurements, and I might be able to draw a conclusion by combining the measurements together in some way. These are all situations in which I can say to my experimental colleagues, well, here's something interesting that you may want to know and you may want to put into practice either with the data you have or with the data you're going to collect in the near future. And if I have something like that to say, I want to say that to people at Atlas. I want to say that to people at CMS. I may want to say that to people at the LHCb experiment, if it's relevant for them, which sometimes it is. And so then it's kind of my job to figure out, well, who are the relevant people who would really want to know this?
Right.
And in a collaboration of 2,000 people, that can be hard to figure out. But, you know, I know a whole
right,
bunch of people
right.
call, and
it's eventually
I usually...
It's who you know
as
I well usually, as what you know, right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. exactly. So it often takes some time to figure out, well, who's really the person or people who would want to know this? And then on top of that, who are the people who need to know it and who need to be pushed to take it seriously? Because they might, if they don't know it or they don't take it seriously, they might block it. They might say, we don't think this is interesting, sometimes
right.
even intentionally
mm-hmm.
or unintentionally.
Ah.
They might, for example,
mm-hmm.
say, well, that's an interesting idea, but it's really not very likely. Let's not waste time on it. Let's not mm-hmm. change the way we collect the data. It's just not important enough. We don't want to, you know, because there's only a finite number of people. 2,000 sounds like a lot, but they have a lot of work to do. So
mm-hmm.
decisions have to be made internally. What things are more important than others. And I don't influence those internal decisions except by pushing from the outside. So
mm-hmm.
I never know, in some sense, whether my suggestions have really had an impact or not. I can only find out later whether they actually did the measurements I suggested or did them in the way I suggested, or maybe they didn't do them at all, or maybe they did them in a different way, which really didn't have anything to do with my suggestion, but that's fine as long as they did them. That's the sort of complicated world that a theorist in this business often operates in, where one pushes as many buttons as one can, but you're never really quite sure unless there are many of us pushing buttons, all the same buttons, and pushing all in the same direction. One's never really sure that one's going to have an impact on how the experiments are actually done.
Right. Speaking of pushing buttons, we've gone into overtime, but
okay.
I wanted to give you a chance to talk about a couple of things. One is people have been asking how things are going for folks who are involved in pure research. This is the sort of thing that doesn't turn into the invention of a new gizmo immediately or finds a way to cure cancer immediately. And so some people wonder how the support for this kind of research is progressing, and you would probably know a little bit about that. And any closing thoughts you had, but definitely I was hoping that you would let people know how to see what you're up to, where you hang out on the web. You mentioned people could send email or get in touch with you, and maybe you could touch upon that. So I kind of rolled that up into one big question. But,
okay.
I hope
don't
field
let me,
it.
Don't let me forget to say something about contact info. The current situation for science in the United States is pretty bad compared to where it was 15 years ago. And it's because of a sequence of events. The Bush administration was not kind to science, generally. By the time they realized that they were actually doing damage to the scientific establishment here in the United States, which of course was the best in the world, 15 years ago, they started talking about reversing the situation, but they never got around to it. And then the recession hit. And,
mm-hmm.
Of course, the recession did more damage. And now we're seeing a political situation where the Republican Party controls the House and Senate, and we're seeing crazy ideas coming out of the Science Committee in the House already in terms of cutting NASA's Earth Science Program by, 18% to 32% just because they don't like the climate science part of it. This
mm-hmm.
is the sort of foolishness that I hope that our government will figure out is really just self-destructive to the country. And we really need to turn things around. Now, fortunately, We've had a lot of 1%ers who've become extremely rich, and so some of them are putting money back into science. But the problem is that they're putting it into very specific areas. And so we are some particular parts of science are getting a boost from private money, but other parts of science that are equally important but maybe not as flashy, and even some that are flashy, such as Large Hadron Collider physics, we're not getting private money. So we've only seen cuts, and the cuts certainly made had a huge effect on my career back in the 2008, 2009, 2010 period. I was trying to put together a center focused on LHC physics, and we just never between university cuts and federal cuts, we were never able to do it. So you know, in general, I think people should be aware that the damage continues to occur, and you know, of course, people do struggle by as best they can. Quality work is still being done in the United States. It's just not what it used to be. We're very fortunate that, we're very fortunate that the Europeans, although they have cut in some areas, have not cut CERN significantly. We're very fortunate that the Japanese and the Chinese are still considering that particle physics is potentially important. The Chinese are considering a major investment, although it's too early to say if that's what they're going to do. And the Japanese are considering a major investment. But the fact the United States is cutting back is making it harder for the Japanese and the Chinese to do it because, of course, they need cooperation from other countries. So you know, within particle physics, there are serious problems, and far beyond particle physics in all areas of science, including medical research, the United States is really taking a major long-term step back from its leadership in research, and this is going to surely have an impact on people's lives here in the United States in ways that are quite diverse. So I hope we'll see a change in that, but at the current political climate, I don't see it happening anytime soon.
I guess the standard advice to listeners is to write your member of Congress, try to find organizations that support good scientific research, that do the sorts of things that Matt is talking about wanting to do, and try to organize in that way. I realize it sounds like a kind of a Pollyannish prescription, but what else can you do?
Well, one thing, of course, is to talk to your neighbors as well. I mean, I think, you know, this is a societal problem. Part of the reason I have my blog and my website is because I feel that we live in a society where people are not sufficiently literate about science, even though they're living in a world that's dominated by technology that's founded on that science. So I'd like to reach people who don't necessarily think about science, and I'd like to give those readers who already do know a lot about science more ammunition, more ingredients for talking to their friends, colleagues, and family about these issues.
That brings us to the contact question.
Right. So you know, I have a website. Of course, it's of particular significance is the name of the blog. The URL is profmattstraffler.com. It has been a little bit quiet over the last year because I've been doing a lot of research. But there are a lot of articles which are sort of long-term reference articles about particle physics and beyond for readers. I have a Twitter account and I've got a Facebook account, and you can follow me there. Those of course, are listed on the website, so you can find those. In general, you know, in addition to you know, appearing on radio shows like this, I do give public talks, and there are a couple of those talks are online, accessible from the website. So I hope that listeners who would like to read more about this subject and like to hear a little bit more about how I try to explain these difficult subjects to non-experts, that they will find the website and some of the videos beneficial and fun and interesting.
And if you're listening, grab a pen and get the spelling of Matt Strassler's name. It's MattStraSsler. And if you plug that into your favorite search engine, you'll probably catch up with everything that Matt's up to. My name is spelled ALANBOYLE, and I hang out at nbcnews.com. And you can find a lot of the stuff that I do at a website called cosmiclog.com. That will put you in touch with the story about Matt and what's going on at the LHC and a lot of other good stuff. So, Matt, I want to thank you so much for being on tonight. This is going to be a good one to go into the books and go into the podcast, and people will be listening to this for years to come, I think. And I also want to thank the Exploratorium for hosting us in their Second Life Auditorium, and thanks to Sherry Reason, our producer at Virtually Speaking. And we have lots of great shows to come, so keep an eye on the Virtually Speaking Science website for more about the frontiers of science. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you very much, John. All right.
Yeah.
I look forward to the next time.
And until next time, watch the skies.
All right.